Today at Reader's Corner, Mitchell Zukov, author of Lost in Shangri-La, a true story of survival, adventure, and the most incredible rescue mission of World War II.
New Guinea was an important place strategically in the Southwest Pacific for the war. It was this place that had gotten this nickname of Shangri-La, where tens of thousands of people lived what was essentially a Stone Age existence. We call it the most incredible rescue mission of World War II because it was one of those rescue ideas that seems doomed to increase the casualty count. The people who experienced this incredible adventure came back to modest lives, told the story mostly just to their children and grandchildren, and were content with it.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. It's fitting that in this month of November, when we celebrate Veterans Day, that we feature a book about the greatest generation. This is no ordinary story from World War II. On May 13, 1945, a group of 24 officers and enlisted men and women stationed on what was then Dutch New Guinea boarded a transport plane named the Gremlin Special. They were headed for a sightseeing trip over Shangri-La, a beautiful and mysterious valley surrounded by steep mountains deep within the island's uncharted interior. But the pleasure tour became an unforgettable battle for survival when the plane crashed. Miraculously, three passengers survived, only to find themselves injured, stranded in a remote jungle, and surrounded by potentially hostile, man-eating headhunters and enemy Japanese soldiers. Their ordeal and rescue is the story Mitchell Zukov tells in Lost in Shangri-La, a true story of survival adventure and the most incredible rescue mission of World War II. His book recounts for the first time this lost story of true life survival and adventure. Earlier this year, Amazon.com named Lost in Shangri-La number one on its list of the best books of 2011 so far, which includes all books published from January through June. Mr. Zukov is a professor of journalism at Boston University and a former special projects reporter at the Boston Globe, where he was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for investigative reporting. He joins us today by phone from Boston. Mitchell Zukov, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much, Bob. It's great to be here.
Well, Mitchell, first of all, where did you find this story? I mean, you rediscovered a story that in World War II was literally on the front page of the New York Times. And
exactly.
And yet over the years, it was lost. And how'd you find this?
This was an incredible piece of good fortune, frankly. I was doing some research on another World War II story when I was doing some research in Chicago Tribune archives from 1945. And my eyes were wandering, and I wasn't finding what I thought I was looking for. And I came upon a headline, "Glider Rescue in Shangri-La Delayed by Clouds." And I couldn't believe it. The fact that there was a story that was so remarkable, so incredible, a rescue adventure story like this from World War II, that had somehow been lost to history. And so I read the story, and like most people, I think I thought that Steven Spielberg had already owned 1941 to 45, inclusive. And there it was, untouched. So I literally, it was just a piece of incredibly good fortune on my part.
I guess. Well, it's just an unbelievable story. Now, you went back to New Guinea in order to do this book. And you describe in the book how inaccessible the place is. I mean, you couldn't get there except by a plane crash, which is why this book comes into being. But now you go back. How accessible is it today as opposed to when these folks were trying to get in to save those who recovered from the crash?
It's not terribly accessible still to this day. There is today a small airport in the center of this valley in a town called Wamena, but it's still an arduous trek to get in there. And frankly, this part of New Guinea is now controlled by the Indonesian government, and they don't really want people going in there. So it's not a place that's going to be in your top 10 travel stories of next year. But for me, it was so important for me to go back there because as a journalist, as an author, you want to know, first, you want to sort of experience as much as you can of a place to write about it. But also for me, it was an opportunity to go and ask the questions of the people who lived in this valley, to ask them what they thought about the outsiders who dropped into the valley 70 years ago. And to get that other side of the story, There was no other alternative. People from the Valley don't leave the Valley, and so I had to go to them.
And you were talking to the sons and daughters of the actual Native people that did meet up with the servicemen and women. Is that correct?
That's correct. And in fact, and some who were children at the time, they had witnessed their parents interacting with the servicemen and the rescuers who came. And so they had firsthand knowledge of what had happened from their perspective. And it was remarkable because just as I think you would imagine if you thought about it, their perspective was often quite different than the perspective of the survivors or the paratroopers. And so it was really interesting to sort of triangulate the two stories, or three stories sometimes, against each other to see how much they understood of each other and what points were missed when they were first all together. And that was just that to me was just a great adventure.
These were natives who had experienced nothing of, I guess, what you could call modernity. So they had no idea what an airplane was. They didn't understand the clothes that these servicemen and women had on them. Isn't that correct?
That's exactly right. In fact, one of the stories that I really enjoyed telling was when some of the paratroopers came in to try and help the survivors, the natives were rubbing their bodies, and the paratroopers, one of whom is still alive, he's 90 years old, he, to this day, was convinced that the natives thought that they were women, and they were touching them because they were women. Well, when I went back and talked to the natives said, no, we knew they weren't women. We had never seen clothing before. We thought maybe it was mud covering their bodies, but no, this was some kind of removable skin like a snake has. And so almost everything about the outsiders, about the survivors and the rescuers, was completely new and mysterious to the natives.
So let's back up just one bit. Tell us where New Guinea is, and what were American military personnel doing stationed on that island in 1942?
Sure. And New Guinea is this tropical island. It's the second largest island in the world after Greenland, and it's just north of Australia. And so it was an important place strategically in the Southwest Pacific for the war. The Japanese invaded early, but then in 1944, MacArthur took back the northern coast of New Guinea, and the town that became the center of my story and the center of where a base was, a major Allied base was the town or the city of Hollandia on the northern coast of New Guinea. And so at that point, tens of thousands of troops and ships and Navy and airmen were all based there because it was a perfect place between Australia and Japan. If and when we had an invasion plan for the mainland of Japan, part of the staging area would have been the northern coast of New Guinea.
And these 24 people who were on this plane were really not on duty on this day. Tell us what they were up to.
You know, the people on New Guinea is a really tough place to be stationed. It's hot, it's sticky, and there's just incredible diseases all over the place. And so they're working 7 days a week. And so once in a while, there would be an opportunity for a rest and relaxation flight, a morale-building flight, so they could see the place beyond their tents, beyond the little base G area that they were stationed on. And so this turned out to be, as you mentioned, Bob, May 13th, 1945. It was a Sunday. It was Mother's Day. And this Colonel Peter Prossen, organized this sightseeing trip. It was really, to put it bluntly, a bit of a joyride to give a little bit of, you know, of fun for some of the people who were working these 7-hour days, 12, 14 hours a day. The idea was they could see this place that the Army had only discovered a year earlier, this place that had gotten this nickname of Shangri-La, this incredibly beautiful, lush valley where the map said there would only be mountains, and instead there was this lush valley in the center of New Guinea where tens of thousands of people lived what was essentially a Stone Age existence, naked except for gourds covering their genitals. These are people who hadn't discovered the wheel, who hadn't discovered textiles or pottery, had no written language, and as you said, practiced cannibalism and were still fighting with, when we were developing the atomic bomb, they were still fighting with bows and arrows and spears and stone implements.
Now, among the military personnel on this plane that would eventually crash and is the subject of your book were a number of women of the WAC, the Women's Army Corps.
Yes.
Help us understand the role that WACs played in the war, and particularly what was Margaret Hastings, who is the sole woman survivor, doing there on that island at that time?
Sure. This was really the first generation of women other than nurses who were serving in the military. The women we have serving in our armed forces today can trace their heritage directly back to the WACs, the Women's Army Corps. And these were women who were almost always doing, you know, just completely support positions. Margaret Hastings, one of the nine women who were aboard this plane, was a secretary back in upstate New York. And she was looking for a bit of adventure in her life. She wanted to serve and contribute to the war effort. And so she signed up and became a corporal in the Women's Army Corps. And so she was stationed in Hollandia as a secretary to this colonel who was a logistical chief of an aircraft unit. And so Margaret, she was looking for a bit of adventure. So when the opportunity came to go up aboard a flight to see this remote valley, she leapt at the chance, as did the other women who were all serving, some, many of whom were her friends. Some were, you know, in nearby tents in the WAC section. And they all wanted to see Shangri-La. And the valley had acquired this nickname. This nickname, I'm sure many of your listeners, Bob, will know, comes from Lost Horizon, the great novel of 1933 that described this beautiful lost valley in the Himalayas. And they had borrowed the name for this valley in New Guinea. And so all of them wanted to see Shangri-La, and the women leapt at this chance and climbed aboard the Gremlin Special.
And the interesting thing about this is the 1940s. Women in the 1940s, if they got through high school, their job was to get married and have kids. Hmm. And here you have a group of independent, strong-willed women, and I know something about this because my wife actually had an aunt who was a WAC. And okay. if she wasn't the picture-perfect Margaret Hastings, there never was one. Because everything that you write about Margaret Hastings, how independent, how strong-willed, how different she was from her girlfriends that just went off to raise families, that's exactly the family stories I've heard over the years. I mean, that really was different, wasn't it? I mean, these women were courageous, among other things, to go to these faraway places. Just to get there was quite courageous, I guess you could say, in those days.
Yes. I love you pointing out this point, Bob. It was such a thrill for me to write about these women who, you're right, we have this image of women in the 40s who are supposed to just go to high school, perhaps, you know, unusual for them to go off to college and just raise families. The women, like Margaret Hastings, the WACs, were people who were breaking out of the bonds, the bounds and the boundaries that had been set for them. They were independent-minded. They were strong-willed. They were adventurous. They were all the things that we sort of attribute today to modern women. A young woman today is expected almost, I think, to explore her own interests and her own ambitions. And so these were women who were really blazing a trail for that. And the fact that the book, just because it's true, had a female heroine made it even more interesting to me because it showed just how modern, even back then, when we might imagine they were a certain way, there were still women back then feeling as though there was more to life than bake sales and PTA meetings.
So this plane crash was the result of pilot error, isn't that correct?
It is.
Yeah.
It's tragic. Peter Prossen was a fine pilot and a really good man, but he made a terrible miscalculation. As the plane was flying into the valley, he left the cockpit. This was a social flight. He was trying to raise the morale of the men and women who worked for him, so he left the cockpit and was standing in the radio compartment talking with some of the WACs and the men who worked for him. And this happened to be at the most treacherous point of the flight. This is where you're flying into the valley, and I actually flew in this same pathway. You're flying in a kind of a notch between the mountains, and there are updrafts and downdrafts. There are clouds covering the mountains. It's very treacherous. And the less experienced co-pilot, a Major Nicholson, simply couldn't handle that part of the flight. And although he tried to pull up and pull out, he in fact ended up crashing the Gremlin Special into this mountain, this jungle-covered mountain.
And in addition to Margaret Hastings, there were two men on board. Tell us briefly about her two other fellow survivors.
Sure. The first was John McCullum. He was a lieutenant, and incredibly, Margaret was hurt. Margaret had suffered some burns. John McCullum emerged from the Gremlin Special wreckage completely unhurt, but he had suffered what can only be, I think, described as an existential wound. His twin brother was aboard the plane with him, and they were inseparable, but they were the last two to board, and Robert McCullum found a seat near the very front, near the cockpit, and John McCullum found a seat next to Margaret Hastings at the back of the plane, and that 12 or 15 feet apart separated them forever. And so when John McCullum emerges in the jungle, he is truly alone for the first time in his life. And the other survivor is Ken Decker, who's a sergeant from the Northwest, from Washington. And he doesn't know how he got out. In fact, he had no memory of the plane flight. He emerges from the Gremlin Special with a terrible head wound. He's cut all the way to the bone of his skull and has no memory from the time the plane took off from Hollandia. He is burned, he is terribly injured, but he is incredibly stoic, and he falls right in and tries to help John McCullum as he and Margaret and John try to figure out, okay, how do we get spotted? How do we try and figure out our way out of here? Because they realized no one knew exactly where they were. They were surrounded by these people they expected to see only from the air, these headhunters, and perhaps some Japanese troops hiding nearby. And they were 150 miles through some of the densest jungles on the planet and mountains from either coastline where the American troops were. So the real challenge for the three of them was, how are we going to be found? And until then, how do we survive?
You're listening to Mitchell Zukov. He is the author of Lost in Shangri-La, a true story of survival, adventure, and the most incredible rescue mission of World War II. Let's fast forward to the rescue mission. So here's this guy, Captain Earl Walter, and he's a frustrated paratrooper who's leading a group of Filipino-American paratroopers, and these guys are trying to find action somewhere, and Earl Walter's father has put the word out that he doesn't want his son to see action, so he's stranded in Hollandia, wishing he could get into real action, but along comes this crash, and what does he do? He volunteers with these Filipino-American paratroopers to go in and get him.
Exactly. And Earl is just a great guy. Earl is still living. He's out in Oregon, and he's become a friend. And Earl, as you described, his father was this legendary leader of a Filipino guerrilla movement in the jungles of the Philippines. And he was risking his life, and Earl wanted to prove that he was as much a soldier and a hero as his old man. And so when his father closed off any other route, this was an opportunity for Earl to prove himself. And so with 10 of his paratroopers, all of whom were, as you described, Filipino-Americans whom Earl had trained for behind enemy lines missions, they were so tired of cooling their heels that when this opportunity came up, they were jumping right into it. Now, they were told, this is going to be the worst parachute drop zone you can imagine. We have no idea how we're going to get you out. You're going to be surrounded by tens of thousands of Stone Age tribesmen who have no idea who you are, and they're likely to be hostile, and they're likely to be cannibals. And still, Earl and his men, their company motto was Bahala Na, which is the Filipino Tagalog dialect for come what may. And they said, come what may, we're ready. And they parachuted in to try and help these survivors and try to figure out a way to get them out.
And when they sent in two medics at first, I believe, didn't they, to help with with the wounds and the injuries?
These two guys, Doc and Rami, incredible heroes, and who were fortunately were recognized with medals for it, jumped into the middle of a jungle in parachutes, which that could have killed them already, and made their way to where Margaret and John and Ken Decker were to help save them.
Now they have to get out. Well, first of all, how long? I mean, this was a number of weeks that they had to actually stay there before the Army could and the Air Force or whoever it was could figure out, how are we going to get these folks out of here?
They were there for almost 2 months, Bob, partially because Margaret and Ken Decker especially, their injuries became more severe. Gangrene set in, and they had to wait for them to heal a bit before they could try to march out of the middle of this jungle to get to the main valley where they might be able to attempt this rescue. And the rescue itself was maybe the craziest part of this whole thing.
And they did in the meantime, before the rescue could be pulled off, have a chance to, I guess you could say, get to know the natives, even though there was no language opportunity here.
Yes. And in fact, when I was in New Guinea, I was able to meet a guy named Helen Ma Wandik. And Helen Ma told me about his father, Wimayuk Wandik, who was the first native to meet the survivors. And there was a disagreement among the natives whether they should kill and eat them or they should befriend them. But Wimayuk took the approach that these were the fulfillment of a prophecy. These people who had come down from the sky fit the general outline of what was called the Uluayak legend. And Uluayak predicted that light-skinned ghosts would come down a rope from the sky. And so Wimayuk decided that they had to be cared for and they had to be protected rather than killed. And not everyone in their clan or in their tribe agreed, but Wimayuk held sway over that. And fortunately for the survivors, they were able to get to know them, and Wimayuk tried to help heal them, in fact.
So now it's time to get out. The Army's trying to figure out how to get them out. Help us understand the options, why some of them had to be discarded, and why they chose the one, what seems to be, most unlikely option.
Well, they thought about helicopters, but helicopters back in that day did not have the lift to get over the mountains and land in the valley, so that was ruled out. They thought about PT boats, like the one that JFK had piloted, but there were no navigable rivers that could get close enough. They thought about blimps. But the problem with a blimp was that it would be subject to the same updrafts and downdrafts that had destroyed the Gremlin Special. They thought about little spotter planes, but they didn't have the range to get in and out, and each one could only carry one other person other than the pilot. So it would be 15 trips or so to get all the paratroopers and the survivors out. So one after another, they thought about marching them out, but that would mean 150 miles through this terrible, treacherous area. So one after another, they rule them out. And then they come up with a plan. In World War II, there were these cargo gliders, these engineless planes that could, you know, be towed in, they thought, and drop down into the valley. And then they would erect what were basically football goalposts on the valley floor and string a giant rubber band from the top across the top of the goalposts, and the other end of the rubber band would go to the nose of the glider. And then they said, we're going to have planes sweep low into the valley, 15 or so feet off the valley floor with hooks on their bellies. And that hook is going to grab the top of that rubber band off of that goalpost and pull the glider up into the air and out of the valley and back to Hollandia. And this was, and we call it the most incredible rescue mission of World War II because it should not work. It was one of those rescue ideas that seems doomed to increase the casualty count.
And it worked three times.
Incredibly. you mentioned you started earlier, and I was so pleased. You know, you talk about the greatest generation, and what that means is a can-do spirit. It means people who know that they have the confidence in themselves and in their ability to carry out a rescue like this. And somehow they made it work.
With three different flights, right? They had to do this three times to get out all 24 because they could only put so many on each one.
Exactly.
I got a kick out of you quoted Walter Cronkite as saying he went up in one of those things once and he almost chickened out. And after he got off of it, he said he'd never do it again as long as he lived.
Yeah, he said, if you ever have to go to war, you know, walk, swim, fly, just anything but go in a glider.
So these folks all get back to America, and this may be, for me anyway, one of the most fascinating parts of the book, because we're all interested in, so, well then, what happened to the greatest generation? And in some way, and by the way, also the natives, because that's a kind of a sad ending to your book, because it certainly doesn't sound like the natives' state of welfare today is much better than it was, probably worse than it was when they were actually discovered.
Yes. It really is tragic. To talk about the natives first, the opening up of the valley ended the native wars, which is probably a good thing. They were not subject to constant warfare with each other. But on the other hand, it didn't replace it with much. And so they lack strong leaders. Illness has come to the valley from the outside world. There's a lack of education, a lack of any kind of economy. And so these people who, again, we might not think that their lives in 1945 were ideal, but they were proud warriors. And as one person who studied them said to me, they have now become almost like serfs in their own land. And so I think that is an unfortunate outcome. For the people who were in the valley, the survivors and the paratroopers, it was remarkable. Today, I think, given our culture, they would be celebrities. They would have all made movies. They would have been maybe on The Apprentice with Donald Trump, some of them. But back then, they were very modest people, and they felt like they had had an extraordinary thing happen to them. But so many people came back from World War II, having done heroic and remarkable things, and they didn't self-aggrandize. They were not looking for, you know, a payday to honor what they had done. They knew that what they had done was special, and that was enough. And so the people who experienced this incredible adventure came back to what you might call modest lives, successful lives with families, with people who loved them, but who told the story mostly just to their children and grandchildren and were content with it. And so when I started researching this, Bob, one of the wonderful things was as soon as I called people and said, I understand your father or your late husband was involved, and they said, oh, yes, and let me tell you, because I'm so proud of him, let me send you some photographs, let me send you some of his letters. And one after another, it was almost like the story was preserved in amber, waiting for someone like me to just call and say, hey, I'd love to tell this story. And so although the people who were involved, most of them were modest and happy to sort of just have experienced it, their family members were enormously proud, and I think deservedly so. And so one of the great things for me about telling this story was a chance to honor them this way.
The survivors got together for a reunion of some kind, didn't they?
They did. In the early 1970s, the glider pilots of World War II invited them to be honored guests at an annual convention. And the three had kept in touch and really had tremendous affection for each other. Until he died, Ken Decker received a phone call every May 13th, which not only was the date of the crash, it also coincidentally happened to be Ken Decker's birthday. He would get a birthday call from John McCollum. And when the three of them were together that final time in the early 70s, it was a really wonderful, I think, experience for all three of them to reconnect and see each other in person, not just through Christmas cards or occasional calls. And sadly, Margaret died a few years later from cancer. But as the glider pilots explained it to me who were there, they said, you know, at that moment, for one last time, she was the Queen of Shangri-La.
Well, Mitchell, we've run out of time, and you can't in a half an hour cover a book like this. And the one thing that you did so well is character development. And I guess that's my final thought to our listeners is it's an appropriate month to remember those who have served our country. And these folks did it in a very extraordinary, unusual, and courageous way. Mitchell, outstanding job in writing this book. We just wish you the best in your future endeavors.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks for having me, Bob.
Mitchell Zukov, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Next week, Joseph S. Nye Jr., author of The Future of Power, which explores how power shifts between nations and why America will continue as a dominating force in the years ahead. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.